This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This is a big week economic numbers-wise, and we got one today, gross domestic product, GDP in the vernacular. It was better than anybody thought, but still, somehow, not good enough. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday. It's the last day of July 2013. Always good to have you with us. Lots going on in the world's biggest economy to get us going today. Starting with this, the world's biggest economy is getting bigger, 1.7% bigger at an annual rate in the 3 months, April through June. So said the Commerce Department this morning. The best minds in the forecasting business, by the way, had gross domestic product coming in quite a bit slower than that. So we can call this a win, right? Yeah, no, hold your horses, everybody. Kate Davidson reports.
Wells Fargo economist Mark Vittner has been saying for years that this is a recovery only a statistician could love. And no offense to statisticians, but he's still saying it today.
Anytime the economy's growing at less than a 2% annual rate, it's really nothing to crow about.
Beating expectations isn't that great when expectations are so low to start with. And to add insult to injury, today's GDP numbers only look high when compared to first quarter GDP, which was revised down. Randy Krosner is a professor of economics at the Booth School of Business in Chicago.
First quarter was actually lower than we had thought, so we're really not much better off today, given that we started at a lower spot than we had thought.
Still, there are some bright spots in GDP land. Consumer spending wasn't voracious, but it led the way. There was also pretty strong growth in business investment. And while the economy as a whole faces headwinds, some sectors are doing fine. Just call Dodge City, Kansas, where agricultural exports are helping drive the economy.
We currently are processing between 60 and 70,000 head of cattle a week.
Dan Schenkein is president of the Dodge City Chamber of Commerce. He says between beef and grain, nobody wants to get out of Dodge these days.
Essentially, anyone looking for a job can work in very well-paying positions here in our community.
Dodge City may be an outlier in that respect. Economists say current GDP growth isn't enough to bring unemployment down, but some expect economic growth to ramp up later this year. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Item two on the news ticker today, jobs. The paycheck processing firm ADP offered its estimate of how many new ones the economy added this month. A nice even 200,000, I'm pleased to be able to say. We'll get the official government-sanctioned July employment report Friday morning. Speaking of which, there is, as you may have heard, a looming opening at the Federal Reserve. It's not quite official, but still widely expected that Ben Bernanke is going to step down when his term running the central bank expires. There is a whole lot of maneuvering going on to see who succeeds him. President Obama, in fact, was on Capitol Hill today talking things over with Congress. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Ben Bernanke's term ends in January, and it looks like he's ready to hang up his Fed fedora. Now there's a very unusual public battle to influence who President Obama taps to replace Bernanke, a Fed food fight between two camps, one supporting Fed Vice Chair Janet Yellen, the other backing former Treasury Secretary and White House Economic Advisor Larry Summers.
I think it's unprecedented, and I think, frankly, it's a little silly.
That's Alice Rivlin. She's a former Fed vice chair. She says there aren't major policy differences between Yellen and Summers, so you have to blame politics.
There is a lot of polarization between the parties and a lot of sense that this is a big moment in the economy, and so everybody's kind of getting their oar in.
A group of Democratic senators sent a letter to President Obama urging him to support Yellen. Newspapers are weighing in with editorials, some highly critical of Summers, and praising Yellen, who would be the first female Fed chair. Ken Kuttner was a Fed economist for 15 years. He says women's rights advocates are lobbying for Yellen to make history.
This would be viewed as a really landmark breaking of the glass ceiling in central banking.
Some Yellen backers are zeroing in on controversial comments Summers made about women, which helped cost him his job as Harvard president. Summers' strong personality is also fueling the public feuding.
As they would say down in Texas, he's a hard dog to keep under the porch.
That's Bob McTeer, a former president of the Dallas Fed. He says all the bickering could make room for a dark horse.
If they kill each other off, if they have a circular firing squad, yeah, that's a conceivable outcome.
But we'll have to wait a while for any outcome. The White House says it won't nominate Bernanke's replacement until this fall. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
As long as we're on the Fed, they wrapped up a two-day meeting on interest rates. Today, as has been the case for going on 5 years now, no change. Wall Street kind of knew that would happen. Traders are waiting on the Friday jobs report, is my bet. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We were informed this week by the often-cited Case-Shiller Home Price Index that the housing recovery continues apace, both used or existing homes as measured by Case-Shiller, and new construction as well. Back during the boom, there was a whole lot of work to be found building those new houses. When things went bust, though, so did the jobs. With housing on the rise, construction jobs are slowly coming back. The question is, will all the workers be coming back for the jobs? Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
At one point, there were so many construction jobs in California that it caused labor shortages in other industries.
You know, there were some years there, back in 05 and 04, farmers couldn't get workers to pick their crops. All these guys who typically would do, say, crop stuff up in the Inland Empire came down here and making twice as much per hour, just carrying around two-by-fours.
Chris Thornburg is a financial analyst at Beacon Economics. By February of 2011, housing construction came to a screeching halt. More than half of residential construction jobs disappeared. Foreclosures skyrocketed, but California was different than other hard-hit states.
Even at the worst of the foreclosure crisis, California had the lowest housing vacancy rate in the nation, which people don't really appreciate.
To get a sense of what this boom looks like on the ground, I visited Jory Blake in Riverside, California.
I'm a humble person. I don't want to sound cocky, but there's nothing about a house I don't know about.
Blake has spent his entire life working in single-family homes. From landscaping to contracting, he eventually worked his way up to a job in land development at Lennar Homes, one of the bigger builders in California. His job was to turn empty desert into master-planned communities.
Designating, you know, the school locations, roadways, how many houses were allowed, paving and things like that. It was awesome. You know, $140,000 a year, shorts and a T-shirt with boots and a nice vehicle and perks and benefits. And, oh, yeah, it was a dream job.
But when the market started tanking, there was a round of layoffs at Lennar. Then another round. Then another.
And they were so good at it by round 13, it was just a machine. All right, bye, Tracy. So, but I was grateful for every minute I had there. And I left with dignity.
Blake did what so many people in the housing industry did. He reinvented himself. Today, he's a realtor.
Absolutely. I had to reinvent myself. Now I'm so planted, it would be hard to get back into that.
That's a problem for the recovering housing industry. Lots of people, from developers like Blake to low-skilled construction workers, moved on to new careers. Meanwhile, home construction is on the rise, and skilled workers are hard to find. I took a trip to Friendly Lane, a street in Riverside, California, where a dozen or so houses are being built.
Construction starting to pick back up, in my opinion. You know, like it's been dead for quite a while. It's pretty steady now.
James Hayes is one worker who stayed in the industry, even though it meant taking a pay cut. Hayes is a carpenter who typically does finishing work. Today he's installing hardware on the exterior doors of a two-story house. But during the lean years,
we just had to find side jobs and stay busy.
That meant taking low-skilled jobs, like picking up nails off the ground. But now that building is picked up, high-skilled workers like him are in demand.
There's most certainly been an increase in the demand for labor in all the construction sectors. There would have to be, given the fact that we've doubled the amount of homes that we built from last year at this time.
Mike Wynn is the CEO of the California Building Industry Association. His organization represents thousands of companies in the industry, many of which are in need of workers.
So we're working with community colleges, high schools, unions, and others on journeyman programs to try to bring those skilled labor folks back into the workforce.
Wynn also tracks building permit applications, which have doubled over the last year in some parts of California. Dozens of workers will be needed to turn each of those permits into houses. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
You remember when Oprah left her big daytime talk show and started up a new network that became a smashing success? Funnily enough, me neither. It's been a rough couple of years for the Oprah Winfrey Network, OWN, to its fans. But as of this week, it is making money. Nancy Kane of the Harvard Business School is here to talk about why and whether that might last. Hey, Nancy, good to have you back.
Always a pleasure, Kai.
Did you ever doubt that Oprah Winfrey was going to make money?
No.
Right.
And that's because I've been watching her for a long, long time.
Okay. So why did it take so long, for her to make money then? I mean, it's been 5 years since she announced this thing, two and a half, I guess, since it went on the air.
Yeah. So a couple of reasons. One, she says this very candidly and was saying it as long as, you know, a year and a half ago. We started before we were ready, right? So I think that's part of it. Second part of it, she started out with the wrong mix of people. Not only in the programming, remember the kind of tempest over having to fire Rosie O'Donnell, but also on her own executive team and who should run this brand new, much more sprawling, much more variegated empire than putting on that very, very successful talk show, The Oprah Winfrey Show. And I think lastly, she had to learn to operate in an environment in which a piece of the action in the form of funding and corporate, you know, advice and input from Discovery was now, you know, part of her GPS. She ran the show at Harpo, she and her trusted long-term team. So I think a bunch of things were new, untested, and didn't work so well.
This might sound a little bit sideways, and I'll grant you that perhaps it is, but has her brand been damaged at all? Not in a tangible, substantive way, but it used to be that every time she turned around, you know, her book club was a huge hit, she gave away cars, all this stuff, and now you're like, oh, yay, she's making money. And isn't that kind of the purpose of this enterprise to begin with?
Absolutely. And I think her brand has taken a hit. But people that know her, historians like myself that look at the long run, you know, always thought that this woman is not only a smart, you know, celebrity, not only a great brand steward of herself, but also she is a really savvy businesswoman. And she's always been able to figure out, you know, how to make lemons out of lemonade. Mm-hmm. So she takes like that big screw up. Remember with James Frey and the Million Pieces?
Oh, yeah, the book thing.
You know, that she endorsed, and she turns that into a huge victory by, you know, pulling him on stage and making him say, I made a big mistake, I didn't tell the truth. And the world loves her and her show and her brand even better. So I've never thought we had heard the last from her, even as, you know, a lot of people were ringing the death knell.
Yeah, no, I grant you that. But let me ask you about what's actually on the air now that she has to make money and she's got other people investing in her company. She's got these shows by Tyler Perry, which have been critically panned, and yet are helping her make money. Is she doing what she has to do now?
So let's just back the tape up a second. If you look at a list of the subjects in a given, say, two-month period, say in 2010 on the Oprah Winfrey Show, you would see subjects from how to choose a bra to, hey, you know, how about these electric cars, to what about humane meat production? She has always had this canny gift for mixing high and low. So, you know, I think that's a conscious play to bring people in through, you know, if you will, the largest and perhaps some would say lowest common denominator, and then offer them up some programming and some messages that lots of us would say were on a higher path.
It's a little bit give people what they want, whatever that is.
Yeah, give people what they want, but, you know, she's pretty serious when she says, I want to help people do better. You know, she's always had a larger, deeper message, and I don't think that's any less true now, but she still has to sell that to to people, right? And that means you may need Tyler Perry to open the door real wide if you're going to bring people into the Oprah Church.
Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, it's a bad time to be a cotton farmer down in Louisiana.
The whole infrastructure is right on the verge of not necessarily collapsing, but it's going to be a lot of consolidation.
But first, let's do the numbers. Up and down day, dazzling month. The Dow Industrials dipped to 10th percent today, 21 points, closed at 15,499. The NASDAQ picked up a quarter percent, that's 9 points, finished at 3626. The S&P 500 pretty much flat. Ended things at 1685. And July, in case you're curious, yes, I know you are, the best since 2010, which somehow seems really, really long ago. The Dow jumped 4%. The NASDAQ packed on 6.6%. The S&P 500 took home 5% this past month. The Fed's no news was good news for financials. Goldman Sachs pocketed nearly 1%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 0.7%. Tough going for Visa after an unfavorable court ruling on debit card fees. The credit card giant threw off more than 7% today. MasterCard was helped by a solid earnings report, closed up 1.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.59%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Upgrade your wheels recently. U.S. automakers are slated to report vehicle sales for July. Starting August 1st, 1981, you could follow music in a whole new way when MTV launched. Or did you follow the Grateful Dead? A symphonic celebration concert is planned in San Francisco in honor of what would have been Jerry Garcia's 71st birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Among the things the House of Representatives has to deal with before members head home for their August recess is the niggling matter of student loans. The deal on the table, which has been a good long while in the making, has undergraduates borrowing at a 3.9% rate of interest, their parents at almost 6.5%. Among the many factors to blame for the delay in finding a compromise is figuring out just how much money the government makes off those loans. As always, and as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore tells us, that depends a whole lot on who you ask.
You'd think that answering a simple question like, is the government making money on student loans, would be pretty easy. It's not. Why? Well, let's try it. Say we're the federal government and we loan $1 million to a bunch of students. David Bergeron is with the Center for American Progress. He says under current accounting rules,
we'd be making around 16 or 17 cents per dollar lent. About $160,000 to $170,000 on the $1 million.
Okay. And if we ask Wayne Weingarten, an economist with the Pacific Research Institute,
the federal government ultimately lends more money to individuals than they receive back.
Okay, well, great. I'm glad that's cleared up. Here's what the Congressional Budget Office estimated for the current student loan program, the one that's about to be replaced. They said the government would make $184 billion in 10 years. That prompted this from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
That's billions in pure profits.
But in another unofficial estimate using a different accounting method, the CBO said the government would lose $95 billion. Again, David Bergeron with the Center for American Progress.
The whole issue is how you value or assess risk.
The risk that you won't get your money back. So when the federal government calculates how much it'll make from student loans, it figures it'll get some from interest, minus some people who default, which was 23% at last count. People like Wayne Weingarten don't like that method.
There are real costs that you're ignoring.
He says student loans are risky, and the returns should be calculated to reflect that risk, the way a private business would make a loan. It wouldn't just factor in the default rate. It would include what's known as market risk, the idea that default rates can change.
The default rates on student loans go way up when the economy is doing poorly, as they did recently, and then they're low when the economy is doing okay.
That's Deborah Lucas, professor of finance at MIT's Sloan School. She says it's like pretending you're investing in gold when you're actually investing in lead. David Bergeron with the Center for American Progress says gold, lead, it was all the same to banks.
My response to that is when banks made student loans, they made a lot of money.
The White House says it has the whole risk thing figured out. It's also worth pointing out that estimates are based on projections 10 years into the future of what interest rates will do. We're having trouble predicting 3 years out. And what about how much the government has actually made in the past? Neither the CBO nor the Department of Education said they knew, which may be why part of the Senate compromise is to make them calculate it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There's a new study out of Georgetown University today. It's titled Separate and Unequal. It says more Hispanics and African Americans are going to college, but their access to the nearly 500 most selective schools just isn't keeping pace. Sally Herships has more now on how inequality in education can perpetuate the economic divide.
If you imagine the American dream as a large red, white, and blue balloon, our education system could be seen as a very sharp pin. According to this new study, there are major perks for white students that their classmates are just not getting. Tony Carnevale is the study's author.
This is not about old-fashioned vulgar racism. This is about the way the mechanics of our economy and our education system are working together to produce racial inequality across generations.
White college graduates from the most selective schools can earn $2 million more over their lives than students who attend less selective schools.
In the end, the school you go to, whether it's selective or not, matters because money matters.
Those most selective colleges spend more per student than less selective schools, sometimes as much as 5 times more. That leads to higher graduation rates and grad school. But even though more African American and Latino students are going to college, they're not going to those top schools at the same rate as white students, even if they're equally qualified. Remember, Carnevale says this isn't outright racism. People are just good at passing down privilege between generations, and white parents are more likely to have gone to college. Naliwe Rooks teaches Africana studies at Cornell.
The way to ensure that intergenerational poverty is not passed on is through education. Well, this kind of inequality ensures that those gaps continue, and it's not good for anyone.
Rook says for some minorities, education isn't helping them. Instead, it's holding them back. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Chances are, given the season and the modern clothing industry, that you're wearing cotton today. The odds are even higher that the cotton you're wearing wasn't grown domestically. Farmers across the South aren't planting like they used to. In Louisiana, acreage is at a record low, and cotton's days as that state's lucrative cash crop have faded into the distant past. Kate Archer Kent from Red River Radio reports.
Ken Cochran can remember how his family was able to eat during the Great Depression. The 93-year-old chopped cotton as a teenager. He earned 75 cents a day.
Working in the cotton field was what was available for cash.
Cochran grew up on a farm in Vivian, Louisiana. A truck would pick up all the out-of-work people from the town square and take them to the fields. He says blacks and whites toiled side by side.
The black man that furnished us our water used to sing a song, and we would hum and we would sing and we would sweat. They didn't give us break time very much.
That was the cotton plantation of yesteryear. And today?
For a dryland crop, this looks phenomenal. We've had really good rains this year.
David Kern stands in a cotton field at the Louisiana State University Research Station in Winnsboro. As the state's cotton specialist, very few farmers are calling on him for advice about how to manage the crop.
It's simple economics. Farmers want to make more money just like anybody else would like to make more money. And currently, they can make more money growing corn and soybeans than they can cotton.
And if the price of cotton stays as low as it is, farmers will start to sell off their machinery, and that could prevent them from ever growing cotton again. With so little of it being planted, that's putting a number of cotton gins out of business.
A lot of machinery. Come on back and watch your head.
John Carroll has been operating a cotton gin in the tiny farming community of Gilbert since 1976, when he took it over from his grandfather. Every fall, he hires a crew of about 15 local men to help him in the around-the-clock ginning process, separating the cotton fibers from the seeds. He says in its heyday, Louisiana had more than 100 cotton gins. There are 29 left.
Most ginners are not young. It's hard work. It's long hours. It's not something that attracts a lot of young people.
Carroll thinks about getting out of the business and selling his gin for parts, but he's loyal to the 20 farmers who'll be bringing their cotton to him come September. And if he quits, he says, it's likely that the big cotton warehousing facility down the road will go bust.
The whole infrastructure is right on the verge of not necessarily collapsing, but it's going to be a lot of consolidation.
The United States is a distant third behind China and India in cotton production. But Kern says the world wants the U.S.'s cotton because every bale is inspected for its quality. He says Texas still plants quite a bit of it because farmers there can't switch over to grain crops due to a lack of water. The cotton ginner John Carroll passed down his farmland to his son, along with some fatherly advice.
Your job is to make money for your family and for your business, and I'm not going to tell you what to plant.
But he definitely didn't steer him toward cotton. In Winsboro, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which Facebook goes toe-to-toe with television and wins, it looks like. The social networking company commissioned the good people at Nielsen to do a survey for them. How many people between the ages of 18 and 24, Facebook wanted to know, are using Facebook during television prime time? Facebook gets a full 50% of those eyeballs, 50%, more than any one of the four broadcast networks. And that perhaps explains this item we saw on Bloomberg today, that Facebook is considering selling television-style ads on its site for, get this, $2.5 million a day. And that is Marketplace for this day. The Dow Industrials dipped a 0.1%, 21 points. The NASDAQ picked up about a 0.25%, 9 points. The S&P 500, we're going to call that basically flat. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us back here tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.